Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Oh, welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. Tonight we have a guest called Steve Frost, and he is the National Secretary of the British Movement. Welcome, Steve. Thanks for coming on.
Good evening, yeah.
Good evening. I first saw you speak at the last John Tyndall Memorial meeting. Then a few months back, I attended a British Movement meeting in York where you spoke. And just the other week, I recorded a speech of yours in the East Midlands, which I played last week. I was surprised at the large turnout and impressed with what you spoke about at York. I didn't realise how active British Movement is these days, but we'll get back to that later if we could. First of all, could I just ask you to explain, for the benefit of the listeners, the history of the British Movement, briefly. When was it founded, etc., etc.?
Okay. British Movement was founded by Colin Jordan in the summer of 1968. And Colin Jordan ran British Movement, taking part in elections and what have you, until he retired in 1975. And in 1975, leadership was passed through to the then National Secretary, Michael McLaughlin, who had previously been the Liverpool and Merseyside organiser for British Movement. And Mike McLaughlin led British Movement until 1983, to roughly September. I joined British Movement in 1976, and Mike McLaughlin was national chairman then. Mike McLaughlin, for various reasons, take far too long to go into it now, stepped down and closed down the national offices in 1983. But contrary to what's said on Wikipedia and in other areas, it didn't go away. British Movement did not pack up. We didn't fold up and run away or lie down and die. A group of senior organisers came together, formed the 1984 committee, and decided that British Movement would continue. And that's what has happened to the present day. We reorganised, restructured, changed direction in a number of ways, in that we are totally extra parliamentary, by which I mean we don't take part in elections. Mm-hmm. We don't see that as the way forward. But we remain, as British Movement always has been, a 100% national socialist organisation.
Okay, thanks for that. Researching the British Movement, I came across the name Nicky Crane.
Yeah.
Did you know him? Do you have any comments about him?
Yes, I knew Nicky Crane. I met him on a number of occasions in the late 1970s, early 1980s. Nicky Crane was a very active street fighter, BM organiser for South East London, not for the whole area. He was very active. He was a very tough guy, and it was quite a sad story. Nicky Crane went to prison after a riot in South East London in about 1981, I think it was, and prison changed him. By that, I mean he became an active homosexual. When I first knew Nicky Crane, he was married to his first wife, Tracy. He later married again for the second time, but while he was in prison, as I say, he became an active homosexual. We didn't know this until much later. This is the post-Mike McLaughlin period, by the way. And I saw him a couple of times at BM socials in South London. Nobody knew what was going on. But then after a couple of years, whispers started to emerge, stories started to leak out, and then the truth came out. The media made a big issue out of it, and everybody abandoned him. Nobody wanted to know him. And within a couple of years, he died of AIDS anyway. Oh, it was tragic.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's quite sad. I think prison does do some pretty strange things to people. How long did he get, Steve, in prison?
Somewhere between 3 and 4 years, I think. But he was put in some... he was on the Isle of Wight, I believe, in one of the maximum security prisons to begin with, because he had a reputation. He was a very, very ferocious street fighter, put it that way.
Okay. Well, I've got a bit of history which includes Birmingham a lot, and being I'm from Birmingham, it's especially interesting to me. In 1969, Colin Jordan put himself up as a candidate for the Birmingham Ladywood by election. Interestingly enough, Oswald Mosley also stood as a candidate in a general election in Ladywood all the way back in 1923. Mosley stood against Neville Chamberlain, the future Prime Minister, Mr. White Paper. And there was controversy at the count. Apparently, as the first vote count saw Chamberlain win by just 2 votes, the second vote saw Mosley win by 7, and the third count, which would be the second recount, saw Chamberlain win by 77 votes. Riotous scenes ensued at the town hall as the winner was declared. Mosley later won the Smethwick by-election in 1926 for Labour. Colin Jordan later on got 3.5 of the vote in Ladywood in 1969. And then in 1970, he stood in Aston. Both of these are heavily black areas now, I'm sure you know. In Birmingham. But Colin Jordan was from Coventry, not Birmingham. So why do you think he chose to stand in Birmingham, Steve?
Well, because actually he was from Birmingham. I mean, Colin Jordan was actually born in Birmingham and grew up in the Birmingham area. And his attachment to the West Midlands was very deep. He in the 1950s, briefly went to live and teach in Leeds, but then returned to the West Midlands. But instead of moving into a house in Birmingham, he and his mother bought a property in Coventry, but his roots were very much in Birmingham, and he had a support base in Birmingham from the NSM days, and he had a lot of contacts in Birmingham. And Colin Jordan had a strong following in Birmingham, and it wasn't until about 1971-72 that he switched his focus from Birmingham to Wolverhampton North East. But he certainly stood as a British Movement candidate in both local elections and national elections in the Birmingham area, as you've said.
That's interesting how you mentioned Wolverhampton. So for listeners who won't know, Coventry is a small city bordering Birmingham, and so is Wolverhampton. Interestingly enough, Enoch Powell was also from Birmingham, but was an MP in Wolverhampton. I think I've got that right.
I was going to say, sorry to interrupt you, but just to point out that there was strong resistance to immigration in the 1960s and early 1970s in those areas. Very strong white resistance.
Yeah, that's good to know. So that's around 1969. Then we get to about 1974, and the vote went to the National Front. There seems to have been a mutual respect between the National Front and the British Movement in the early 1970s. I understand John Tyndall met with Jordan in 1972 with the idea of BM activists forming a new NF branch in the West Midlands. This never happened at the time, as far as I can tell. Do you have any thoughts on this period? And did you know John Tyndall personally?
I didn't know John Tyndall personally, but if I can just clarify a few things. Colin Jordan and John Tyndall had a long history together going back into the 1950s, to the end of the 1950s, and they'd been collaborators politically in the 1960s. I mean, they were both involved in the National Socialist Movement, but then they split. John Tyndall went his way, Colin Jordan went his. Because Colin Jordan, unfortunately, served a prison term for racial hatred. He was sentenced in 1967, and didn't come out until the spring of 68. And he was not welcome in the National Front, was Colin Jordan. John Tyndall at that time wasn't leading the NF. It wasn't until the 70s that John Tyndall was leading the NF. And there were some elements within the NF who did not want Colin Jordan involved. Now, unbeknown to these people, John Tyndall and Colin Jordan were in regular contact. And certainly there was a mixture of opinions, but they didn't see eye to eye on everything. Colin was determined to continue a more national socialist approach, whereas John Tyndall wanted a more British racial nationalist approach. And there were periods where there was tension between NF and BM, but there was also periods where there was a lot of collaboration between the two.
I see. So it was A.K. Chesterton who started the National Front, is that right?
He was one of those, yes. He was heavily involved in it.
Andrew Fontaine, the aristocrat?
Yeah, and Andrew Fontaine did not want any contact with Colin Jordan.
Yeah. Okay. What I do like is the way Colin Jordan was trying to unite the various white racial groups, which seems to have happened eventually, because you had the League of Empire Lawless, the White Defence League, and eventually they seem to acquiesce and all come together with the National Front. It does make sense to me, sort of looking back, as obviously I wasn't there, that the British movement dropped out of electoral politics, thus leaving the road open for the National Front. I understand you got involved in 1976.
That's correct.
So we come back to Michael McLaughlin, who took over the leadership of the BM around that time. We've all already spoke about him a bit, but is there anything else you'd like to say about Michael McLaughlin?
Yeah, when I joined BM in 76, Mike McLaughlin had taken over in 1975, and he was reshaping BM to his vision, if you like. He was taking it away from the model that Colin had put together. Not totally. He was retaining the National Socialist roots and all the rest of it. But Mike McLaughlin had his own ideas about how things should be done. And it didn't always sit well with some of the membership, and certainly with the Colin Jordan loyalists. Mike wasn't the easiest person to get on with as far as some people were concerned. Personally, I never had any problems with him. He was much older than me. He'd got far more political experience than me, and he was a skilled organizer. And certainly he put BM back into the national headlines. Not for the right reasons, but we certainly got a lot of press coverage through Mike's activities. But then when he decided to go, the nature and method of his leaving is what left a bad taste in the mouth of a lot of people. And it took a lot of salvaging. And there are still people in BM today who were around then who are very antagonistic to any talk of Mike McLaughlin.
Oh, that's a shame. I think so. So he did a lot of good stuff, but he kind of left under a cloud. Would that be fair to say?
Left under a cloud of his own making, I would say. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Then in 1980, the name Ray Hill comes up. I understand he was a red mole. For anyone who doesn't know what that means, that's kind of an infiltrator. And tried to cause problems for the NF and British movement. What would you say about this period, and that's the early 80s, and the success of the Jewish-led anti-fascist searchlight in sowing division and splits?
I've always felt that the role of a Ray Hill was exaggerated. Ray Hill was without doubt a paid agent. I've read his book. I've read his various newspaper articles. I've seen him interviewed on TV. I saw the Channel 4 documentary that he originally made back in the 80s. There is a good deal of exaggeration in all that. Ray Hill did damage. I would be a liar to say otherwise. Mm-hmm. But what he did was he exploited situations that were already there. There were rifts and divisions within the National Front at the time. There were rifts and divisions within British movement. And what he did was he exploited those. He was an agent provocateur. He stirred up trouble. He set personalities against each other. He created problems where none existed previously. He was very divisive. But I don't think a lot of that was down to himself. I think he was very much being directed and pointed and given targets and told to do this and told to do that, and which he did. But it's an exaggeration to say that he wrecked BM in total, because he didn't. Because I can remember the period very well, and certainly where Ray Hill had some influence in some of the Midland branches and some of the London branches and one or two of the Southern branches, certainly north of Derby, the north of England, Ray Hill wasn't tolerated at all. He very, very rarely tried to put any input up here because nobody trusted him. Nobody liked him. And when the splits came, most of the splits occurred within the Midlands and within the Greater London area, and that was down to Ray Hill. But there were other problems internally at the time, and it was a cocktail of events. it didn't help. It created a lot of problems. And certainly it set the National Front and British movement back many years.
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, you get so many people working hard and, you know, you've got a mixture of working class people, middle class people. Everything's going well. And because they wear the same uniform, by that I mean they've got white skin, it can be hard to spot these kind of agent provocateurs, can't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And especially when they are well-resourced and are, you know, being given definite targets and definite agenda, do this, which he certainly was, which he certainly was.
Fair enough. McLaughlin announced the closure of British movement in September 1983.
That's correct.
According to Wiki, and I know you say there's a lot of errors with Wiki, he blamed the court case brought by Ray Hill, which drained British movement funds. If this is true, it's funny how history repeats itself, Steve, with what's going on in the current National Front. Your comments on that, please.
Well, certainly there was never a court case over Ray Hill. Ray Hill issued a writ against Mike McLaughlin. And Mike McLaughlin spent an awful lot of money preparing a legal defence. But there were other issues at the time. British movement at the time was financially not very secure at all, and none of that helped. The parallels, well, what's going on in the NF at the moment is history repeating itself as far as the NF is concerned. I've seen this with the National Front before. The National Front has gone through splits in the past, where you've got different factions within the NF who are vying for the leadership and for the control of the front. It's regrettable because it's costly. It creates a lot of bad blood and it undoes a lot of good work. And unfortunately, these situations also upset people who drop out. People who've been good activists, good supporters, they drop out because they see their work going down the drain. And they see resources going down the drain. It's not their doing. They don't want to take sides. And so they just drop out. And some people stay out for years. Some people stay out forever. And those are the parallels.
Yeah, it really is a terrible thing. I mean, for example, I was going to stand for the National Front in my local area this year. And now the person who is still in charge of nominations, he said that there will be no National Front candidates. So, I mean, I'll stay with it. Like, I spoke at the last meeting in Birmingham and I says, well, if we can't stand next year, I'll stand next year. But it really does get you, doesn't it? Because this was this year as well. I mean, UKIP aside, I think it would have been the year that the National Front overtook the BNP. I mean, speaking of Birmingham specifically, I know we could have got more candidates than them. And, it kind of makes you feel impotent. But then again, I mean, it's certainly, you would agree that it's not all about electoral politics. I mean, the National Front is very, very active now. They've got people doing a lot of stuff in Wales, Scotland, north of England, south of England. So, I mean, we're on the streets. There's no doubt about that. But let me ask you then, in 1983, you took over, at least became the main point of correspondence for the British movement. But apparently there's errors in Wiki again. I mean, that last error was quite significant. If they say it was due to a court case and there wasn't a court case. So people certainly need to be careful when looking at Wiki for things. But could you just put the record straight, because Wiki's obviously no use. What happened in between 1983 and 1985 in regards to you kind of taking the reins, or at least being the person who says, yep, send me the correspondence, I'll deal with it, I'll get things moving again?
Right. Without giving too much away, I have to be careful what I say here. I certainly didn't take over. I know I've been accused by Wikipedia of taking over the leadership at that time. Certainly not true. I was approached by senior BM organisers at the time. I was involved with the 1984 committee, and I was asked to set up a PO box contact address for BM so we could start the reconstruction work, could start the reorganization of BM. And we needed a PO box address. And the point was made to me that it didn't want to be in London, because had it been in London, then our political opponents would have swarmed all over it. The mail would have been getting stolen. It had been getting, you know, the security service had been on it. So somewhere obscure. And by arrangement with one of my close comrades here in Yorkshire, we set up the PO box here. And all we did was take up the mail, answer the mail in some cases. More important mail was passed on to the 1984 committee and to the national chairman. It was seized on by the left. Obviously, they saw there was a PO box operating, so they put two and two together and made six. They found out who the name was behind it and immediately said, "Ha, he must be the leader." No, I wasn't. I was acting under instructions. And not to put too fine a point on it, I got involved with the developing administration of BM, but certainly not the leadership of it. At that time, and Wikipedia is way off the mark. I've read it a number of times. Their analysis of what BM did is entirely wrong. If we can leave it at that.
Yeah, sure. That clears it up quite a lot. But I mean, for all intents and purposes, I suppose in a way you had become leader, right?
No, I would say, to all intents and purposes, head of administration, if that's okay. Not too grand a title.
That's fine. Well, you are kind of, you're the national secretary now.
I'm national secretary now, but I wasn't then.
Okay. When did you become national secretary?
I've been national secretary for about 10 years now.
Okay. Well, that's quite long. Let me move on to something else then. I see British Movement has been connected to Blood and Honour, the skinhead music operation, which is worldwide. Mm-hmm. And that was of Ian Stuart Donaldson.
Yeah.
I know the link between British Movement and Blood and Honour still exists to this day.
Yeah.
Did you know Ian Stuart, and do you think it was strange that he died in a car crash at the age of 36? Just like Jörg Haider of Austria, who was also relatively young and died in a car crash. Do you think Ian Stuart was taken out?
To answer it as you've asked it, BM has had an involvement with Blood and Honour for a long time. But just to clarify it, this is another mistake some left-wing researchers and journalists say. BM has never controlled and has never run Blood and Honour. The fact is that there are some Blood and Honour people who are also BM people, and some of the bands have strong BM membership, but Blood and Honour is an organisation in its own right. Ian Stuart, I only actually met Ian once. I met him at a BM social in South London, unfortunately, but some colleagues of mine in the BM were very close friends of Ian Stuart's, very close friends of his indeed, and I remember when Ian Stuart was killed, one of my comrades phoning me in tears and saying, "Ian's dead." And I couldn't believe it because I knew he'd been badly injured in the car crash 2 or 3 days before. And it's one of those things, you know, do you become a conspiracy theorist or do you not? The vehicle in which Ian Stuart and Steve Flint, who was also killed in the crash, was supposedly roadworthy. And I believe at the time the police stated that they could find no mechanical reason for the vehicle crashing. Something
I've heard that as well. Hadn't he had MOT a few weeks before or something? And the MOT, which for anybody who doesn't know, in Britain, if you've got a car, every year you have to have an MOT, which checks the car is safe and everything, and it's a legal document. Legal document is signed, this car is safe. And I believe that happened only a week or two before. So it's very strange that he should have whatever happened, the brakes failed or whatever.
Yeah, I've always had my doubts about what happened to Ian Stuart. I think he was too big a target for them not to have a go at him. I do know that certain elements within anti-fascist circles have boasted at various times that they were responsible for taking out Ian Stewart. I don't believe that to be the case. I think that's just empty boasting by a load of empty heads. The place to look, if Ian Stewart were killed, if there was a reason for killing him, one of two directions. Either the state,
using MI5. The principles,
either MI5 or one of its offshoots, using the methods they perfected in Northern Ireland, or B, Mossad. One of the two.
I was thinking the second one too. It's a bit like in America, because we'll have a lot of American listeners here. Have you heard of Matt Hale?
Yep.
All of a sudden, I mean, he was so good at speaking. I saw him on some show on one of the Jewish networks, NBC, I think, and he was ripping the guy apart, the guy who was trying to call him a racist, quote unquote. And I love watching it. I've watched it many times. The way he says, well, we don't believe in your belief system. You can call me that all day long. And all of a sudden, they had connection problems, you know, and the screaming, shh, and there was like a grey screen. Well, when do any of these big American networks have connection problems? It doesn't happen. And then eventually he was accused of planning the murder of some Jewish judge, I believe. And, well, he's locked up now. That's one they don't have to worry about. Another case was Edgar J. Steele. Have you heard of him?
No, I don't believe I have.
Well, what his remit was, he was a lawyer, and he would, amongst his usual work, when there was sort of white nationalists who was in legal trouble, he would kind of help them, pro bono or not. And next thing you know, it's a really weird story. It was like they got the whole picture right. They says that he was to do with a car as well, funnily enough, that he had planted a pipe bomb or some kind of bomb under the car to blow up his own wife. So that was kind of attempted murder. And at the same time, they cooked up a story that he'd been trying to arrange Ukrainian women to go and meet a Ukrainian woman for marriage. So it's like you get these people who are very, very good at what they do, and they're a threat to the system. So they'll try their legal ways first, which might be smears, sexual smears, financial smears. Well, if that doesn't work, or if the person is too clean, they will go with plan B, which is take them out the picture, either by locking them up for an awfully long time or killing them. I certainly think that's what we're up against, but it's nice to know that Ian Stewart Donaldson has a kind of annual memorial thing, concert.
Yes, absolutely.
Could you speak a little bit about that? Because I'm not really blood and honour. I mean, I would like to go to one of those concerts, but maybe listeners might want to sort of get involved in blood and honour and the Ian Stewart Donaldson memorial gigs.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, I'm not a member of blood and honour, but I've a lot of good friends who are. And not just in the BM, I know people who are totally devoted to Blood and Honour, and they're very skilled in what they do. The events they put on are very, very well organised. Of course, the state doesn't like it. Every year when the annual ISD, the Ian Stewart Donaldson Memorial gig, it's a weekend these days, it's more like a festival, there are all the usual shenanigans, you know, from the police and from the anti-fascists and whoever else to try and disrupt it. They don't want it to take place because it's
amazing we can still get a venue for any of these things.
Yeah, I mean, the organisers work very, very hard on that. I mean, last year was the 20th anniversary. September 2013 was the 20th anniversary of Ian's death. And I was present there as a good sized BM contingent there. I'd say there was well in excess of 1,000 people there over the weekend. Some people came, some people went. It was very well organised on private land, and it policed itself. You know, there's all the usual entertainments there. There was all the refreshments, bars and all the rest of it. Very well done. And internationally, the number of people who came along and took part in what was essentially a National Socialist event was terrific to see. I lost count of the different nationalities that I spoke to and you know, met there last year. It was marvellous. It's a classic example. Blood and Honour brings together white people worldwide. And I think that's the legacy. That's, if I can just say, sure. Ian Stuart Donaldson's legacy. On one hand, you've got the music, but on the other hand, I think that that element of international brotherhood that is there with Blood and Honour, that is also part of Ian Stuart Donaldson's legacy.
Sure. That's what I've got a friend who goes to a lot of the Blood and Honour concerts, and that's what he always says to me. He says, the great thing is, Paul, he says, you meet Swedish nationalists, Germans, Croats, the whole works, even Russians and stuff like that. So yep. I probably should mention now, there's a St. George's Day, Blood and Honour, which is in Coventry. It's either the 23rd or the 26th. It might be the
26th.
Yes, which is the Saturday, right?
Yeah.
So I may try and go for that, but listeners might be interested, certainly UK listeners, to Google St. George's Day, Blood and Honour, 2014. And as you're saying, Steve, they'll meet some really interesting people who are openly National Socialist. I know that the enemy media and the Jewish-led antis like to say that National Socialism is long dead, but I think they're quite wrong on that.
Absolutely.
Sure. Well, let me go into something else then. In the early 1990s, Combat 18 appeared, who was kind of a, I don't know whether I should use the word paramilitary or like a street movement. And John Tyndall believed they was a state operation. What comments do you have regarding Combat 18?
Well, obviously, I'm strongly prejudiced against Combat 18 because Combat 18 was, I emphasise, it was all the worst elements came together to launch it. Charlie Sargent particularly. I know he's out of prison now, but for somebody to be a professed National Socialist and go and murder one of his own comrades speaks for itself. I believe it was very much a state setup. And I believe that people operated within parameters that were set by the security services. I think at the time, the remit of Combat 18 was to dominate the racial nationalist scene in the UK if it could, and to wreck the electoral perspectives of the British National Party. And then as a secondary, to damage and wreck any other organisations. I mean, they tried to destroy Blood and Honour by taking it over and milking it dry and exploiting it for money. BM, we refused to have anything to do with Combat 18. We didn't trust them. We didn't want to have anything to do with them. And for that reason, Combat 18 targeted BM quite seriously. Certainly, my name was bandied about and slandered. But some of my comrades were certainly targeted for a great deal of violence for the simple reason that BM would not throw its lot in with C-18 and its political offshoot that it later launched, the National Socialist Alliance, as it was called at the time.
Are you saying that Combat 18 activists physically attacked British movement activists?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and BNP activists. It was said at the time that Combat 18 carried out more physical attacks on racial nationalists than it did on the left.
I saw that quote around, yeah. Well, that should tell people. I mean, at the time, perhaps, you know, people would have thought it's a good organisation, but surely by now people can look back and realise. But unfortunately, Steve, I still see white racial nationalists posting graphics of Combat 18, you know, that famous graphic with the holding up a machine gun with the swastika.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a real shame. So hopefully people who might listen to this, I will share it around, can have a think about that, because I don't think, especially from what you've said, Combat 18 is anything to be proud of. I think that should be in the dustbin of British nationalism. Would you agree with that?
What I would say is this, that there were genuine people drawn into the sphere of Combat 18. They were drawn in because they thought they were getting involved in something that was going to be direct action on the streets, taking on the Reds head on. Occasionally that did happen, but there were other agendas running there. There's a mythology grown up about it. I mean, there are people out there who didn't go through that period, who've latched onto the name, as you say, who've latched onto the insignia. And there are one or two people, I'm sure, out there who still think that there is some value in calling themselves Combat 18. I do know there were people carrying things out who were not involved in it at all. They just liked the imagery and they liked to, you know, put the slogan C18 on the wall and parade about the place. But they didn't actually know anybody involved in it.
Yeah.
But there was, as I say, there was a lot of bad blood between C18 and the BM and the BMP.
It's funny how you mention about C18 on a wall, because I bet you, if you really spent the time, if you had a spare day and you wanted to drive around, you would find C18 on a wall somewhere.
More than likely.
You do see that, but there you go. Okay, well, moving on then, we've kind of covered the history of the British movement, and we're up to the present day.
Mm-hmm.
Does British movement see itself as a vanguard of the British people? If so, what differentiates it from other supposed vanguards, such as the British National Party, British Democratic Party, or the National Front?
Right, well, there's a simple answer to that. The three other organisations you've just named all seek to influence through the ballot box. And we certainly do not. We see ourselves as a cadre organisation, and our aim, I don't want to give too much away because there's always hostile agencies listening in, but our aim is to be a grassroots National Socialist movement, not a political party. We're not interested in taking part in the political game because we see it as a rigged game. If people want to get involved, stand as candidates, try and chase the votes, fair enough, let them do that. And we have in the past provided manpower to support candidates from genuine racial nationalist organisations. But we feel that the way forward is to act as a vanguard, if you like, in preserving British National Socialism, in promoting British National Socialism, and in creating a National Socialist alternative. We see the way forward, and have done for some years, as creating a counterculture so that we create our own support networks, we create our own entertainments, we create our own activities that our people can be involved in without having to take part in what the state provides or what multiracial society provides. We can provide diversions and activities for our people that way. Eventually, we want to be big enough to be able to provide things like education for children. And we also, as I think you're aware, have a long-standing project where we want to own land.
Yes, I have heard about this, and I think your kind of plan is much more realistic than Western Spring, who want to raise huge amounts of money in the regions of 300 million. Whereas my kind of thinking is, why don't you try and get some little village going to start with, even if it's only 6 dwellings? To me, that would be a better achievement. Even if it's only 6 little properties on a little patch of land, well, that's a start. Personally, I would rather support a project like that than a lofty project, which is talking about raising hundreds of millions of pounds and putting candidates undercover in the Conservative Party and the Labour Party and all this kind of thing. Is there a name for your this kind of side project of starting working? No?
No, we've always just referred to it as the Land Project.
The Land Project,
and,
okay.
Yeah, and the idea is that without giving too much away again, is that we look up and down the country at different places and look for small parcels of land. That's the plan. So that rather than looking to build houses and take over places and huge estates, what you would look at is small parcels of land dotted up and down the country that can be used for outdoor activities, and then build on that. When you've got some momentum in that project, then start looking to buy houses and properties and start renting properties to fellow National Socialists so that they are paying rent to National Socialist organisation.
Sure. So maybe start somewhere small, get a cheap parcel of land, maybe somewhere in Wales, and then put up a few chalets and then, you know, say to some people, well, have you got £20,000? We've got a very cheap chalet. It's only basic. It's got 2 bedrooms and electric, and that's about it. It's very basic, bathroom, kitchen, nothing fancy. But by you buying this little plot, then you are helping the next person buy their plot. And I definitely think that is the way to go, to start small.
So, yeah. That's roughly the idea. And of course, there's always the added attraction that as an organisation, we would start owning parts of our own country again.
Blood and soil.
Exactly.
Okay. I meant to ask about the Combat 18 stuff, about Harold Covington, because he in America, apparently I was reading what John Tyndall said at the time, all the kind of membership lists, if you applied, basically, if you lived in London at the time of Combat 18 in the early 90s and you sent your information off, you says, yeah, I'd like to be a member and all this, apparently that information would find its way into Harold Covington's PO box in America. And we know that the American Secret Service works closely with the British. So I think that was kind of another aspect of that. It was a bit more international, wasn't it?
I believe so, to begin with. I mean, personally, I have never met Harold Covington. I've never had any contact with him. And I do recall that when Combat 18 was first on the go, they were, in fact, using a USA-based PO box address.
Yeah, that was his.
Yeah, and I've heard all the stories, but I've never experienced any of it personally. But I've heard all the stories. And certainly you've got to believe that agencies like the FBI and CIA work hand in glove with our own MI5 and MI6, as well as other overseas organisations and security services. So you can't be surprised by anything at all.
Absolutely. Okay. It also says on the internet that the British movement still exists, but, I quote, is largely inactive. From attending a few of your meetings, Steve, I know that's false. I also saw a British movement member with a Sunwheel flag just yesterday, 5th of April 2014, at the White Pride Worldwide Rally in Swansea. And that was good old Dave there. Could you tell us a bit about the BM in 2014? Activism-wise, what can we look forward to in the near future?
Right, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Well, first of all, the Wikipedia thing, I've laughed at that before today, but if they want to delude themselves with that kind of thing, let them go ahead deluding themselves. I mean, to quote one of my comrades here in the Sunwheel office team, who, you know, helps out at the BM office, he always says, if that's all they know about us, good. His opinion is that the least that our opponents know about us, the better we like it, which is fair enough.
Yeah,
I mean, street activism, we returned to street activism properly last year. And what you're going to see is going to be far, far more. It's a snowball effect of literature distribution, paper sales and so on. What we're not doing is we're not getting involved in the old tactics where BM used to stage mass marches and protests and what have you, because the situation's changed, and we won't be doing that.
Sorry to butt in, but the police guidelines now are so strict. You'll end up getting kettled, and it was like yesterday we were supposed to do our thing, which was good, with all the flags and the speeches. That Adam Lloyd of South Wales NF really did a good job. I'll be posting up his speech on the show page. But when we left, we were supposed to march, and I put march in quotes, because the police come round and they said to me, you have to drop your flag down now, the Celtic Cross flag. I says, well, why? He says, well, that's what we've agreed. So, I mean, what kind of a march is it when you have to put your flags down? That's not kind of a march. So I understand what you're saying there. Sorry to put in.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, we are looking, as I say, towards building up a grassroots movement. So a lot of our activities are aimed at creating private social events, private activities, outdoor events, camps, and so on, cultural events, where the state can't interfere, where our opponents can't interfere because they don't know it's happening, and yet our people will get maximum benefit out of it. We are going to be building even more on our Young Wolf youth section over the coming years. There's going to be greater expansion of the activities of the BMWD, which is the British Movement Women's Division, as well as our own bodies of activists building up branches, building up divisions, and getting out there, holding formal meetings. You've been to a couple, but we'll have more of that sort of thing. And I don't want to give too much away here because, you know, the best will in the world, people will look at us and saying, oh, yeah, you think you're going to do that. We'll make sure you don't. So we just have to box clever, but we have a lot of projects in the pipeline over the next couple of years that we want to bring to fruition. And certainly, as far as we're concerned, we want to build on successes and to create a genuine British National Socialist movement that is a national network.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. well, I was looking at the, I think it's NS. Oh, damn, you'll have to remind me of the name. Your main blog is
NS Outlook. Yeah.
That's it. I'll put a link on the show page for anybody who wants to look. And, well, there seems to be quite a lot of activity going on. Not too long ago, you had the solidarity with the two Golden Dawn activists who got assassinated. And I saw just today you're doing food banks, helping out the poor and stuff. So that's all good stuff. Hopefully something will take form in the West Midlands, because I know that's not an area you're strong in at the moment. It was nice for me to see when I went to a demo in Coventry, which National Action organised, that a couple of British Movement activists was there. I like this kind of co-cooperation. What do you think of what National Action are up to?
Well, we're very supportive of National Action. It's been part of our policy for a number of years to support genuine racial nationalists and to lend some manpower along if they need it. National Action, you know, I like the idea of the flash demos and short demonstrations that they carry out, that sort of almost guerrilla politics, if you like, like that. And certainly we've no problem about supporting that sort of thing.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's good to support each other, especially, as you say, when you're a genuine racial nationalist. I remember from your meeting in York, you spoke about cultural events, which you mentioned briefly, but you mentioned things like the Sunwheel Festival. I mean, I count myself as a pagan, so I found that interesting. But if listeners wanted to join the British movement, what would they be invited to? How would they go about joining? And are overseas members permissible?
Yeah, we have we've always had overseas associate members. Here in the UK, it depends where you are. Obviously, we're better organised in some areas than others. The Sunwheel Festival is, in fact, an event that's run every year by the Northern region, which is north of England region, but people come from other areas as well to take part in it. And it's a family event. It's a National Socialist family event that's timed to coincide with the summer solstice. It's a weekend event, camping, you know, campfires, barbecues, all that sort of thing. Live music, usually. We usually have some of the bands come along and entertain us. And there's other events put on. We've had stuff for the kids, games organised for the kids. We had somebody who did a foraging morning with all the kids to teach them what plants you can eat, you know, in the British hedgerows, what sort of things you can find, you know, naturally growing wild herbs, what different herbs are used for. We had somebody, one of our members, his wife is an expert in this sort of thing, and she came along and she took all the kids along and said, look, this is called such and such, you can use it for this. This is called such and such, use it for that. And so basic survival, outdoor survival skills. So it's a very relaxed atmosphere. You know, people don't have to get involved in the activities. If they want to sit, you know, round their barbecue, have a drink and chat with everybody, that's fine. That's what goes on. I mean, last year we had a bit of comedy because we had a regional cook-off. We had Yorkshire and Lancashire competing for regional dishes in a competition with a joke entry by Nottinghamshire. And it just gives a nice, relaxed atmosphere. You know, we had somebody came along and donated bags of sweets for all the kids that were on site. Mm-hmm. That's the idea, that you've got relaxed events like that. And there's more serious things. I mean, this year, Chris Donald, who was the Scottish, the Glaswegian teenager, was murdered by an Asian gang a few years ago. One of our Scottish activists went as a delegate to lay flowers at the Chris Donald memorial bench. So there are more serious things that we take part in.
Was that in conjunction with the Scottish Defence League?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, did you know that the BNP posted that on their website?
No, I didn't. No, I don't monitor all the other nationalist websites. But we did have a spray of flowers laid there by a representative of BM, because there are things like that that need to be remembered. And of course, there'll be some music events staged up and down this year. Last year, our South East London and Kent region put on an April 20th gig down in the South East. Things like that go on, you know, so it's not all hardcore serious politics all the time. We try to have some fun. We try to have some social events, and we also try and have some cultural events. Our South Wales people, you know, took all the kids and families along to visit Caerphilly Castle. This sort of thing, you know, it's learning with a small L for some people, but it also means that we can get the kids along to things, paintball weekends, this sort of thing, which builds up comradeship, gives activities for families under a national socialist umbrella.
That's great. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in our modern society, Steve, that they're living in their little boxes and they've got their internet, but they've got very little human interaction. And there's a very high number of single people, mm-hmm. more than ever in history by far, who are living on their own. But there's an awful lot of people who they agree with your politics. They agree with something more than just paying the bills and going to work, something spiritual, something they can really meet good people and enjoy themselves. And it's all right meeting good people and enjoying themselves down in the pub or down in the club, but there's nothing really ideological to it. I like the way you've got both. You've got friendship, comradeship. And if people are not so political, that's okay. They can come along, they can have fun. But for people who want to really get serious, and I'll use your phrase, no salt in the soup, if they want to be real national socialists, there's an organisation out there called British Movement. Could you just say the main email address that people might inquire to?
Yeah, it's sunwheelteam@gmail.com.
sunwheelteam@gmail.com.
That's right.
That's good. I'll put a link on the show page as well. Okay, well, now we've only got 5 minutes left. I can afford to tempt fate. Funnily enough, Steve, the audio has been absolutely perfect, even though you're on a wireless connection and we had a lot of problems. So that's good. I'm very happy about that. But last week I played your recent East Midlands speech, which was in Mansfield. At the end of my show, someone named Judith left a comment on the White Network. I'll just read it to get your answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment was, Paul, I enjoyed your programme as always, but listening to your last speaker, who is to be your guest next week, that's you, mm-hmm. I wondered if he was failing to see the bigger picture regarding massive Muslim immigration to Britain. Yes, Muslims are an increasing problem, but they are simply one weapon of many being used against us by those whose cold, calculated agenda is to destroy the white race. I trust you will be discussing the cause, not just the symptoms. So we've got 4 minutes left. Could you address that comment, please, Steve?
Right, well, I understand exactly what that person's saying, and I agree. The meeting last week was just to focus on the threat of Islam and radical Islam and the jihadists here in the UK. But as a National Socialist organisation, we're certainly not blind to the other horns. I think you'll recall last week one of our other speakers said Islam is just one of the horns on the beast.
Yeah, I think that was Neil, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And the whole point is we're fully aware that there are very real threats to this country. And we know who the hidden hand is. The hidden hand is the same hidden hand that's been attacking this country and pulling the strings for the best part of a century. And we're certainly not blind to that. And we're not so naive as not to recognise that it is just one element of what is wrong here. Britain has been very seriously undermined. And certainly since the late 1940s, immigration in all its forms, and I'm not just talking about the Islamic element of the immigration, I'm talking about all the racial, all the non-white, all the non-Aryan elements that have come in. They are a serious, serious problem for us, but they are not the total picture. They are part of the symptoms of what is going on. And we know that there is a much bigger globalist agenda behind what is going on here. But you have to treat the symptoms. And in order to deal with the situation, I would say you have to break it down and recognise each threat. And each threat is a dagger aimed at Britain's heart.
Yeah, I mean, you see, because somebody sent a comment to me and they said there was a quote by some European Jew who had spoke about genocide in a white race. And he says, just put that leaflet out. But the problem is people are not seeing huge synagogues spring up. People are not seeing gangs of Jews grooming and raping their daughters. People are not seeing young Jews at school beating seven shades out of their sons. So this is the kind of awkward thing for people like us, I think, that we have to kind of get a balance of pointing out what's happening on people's doorsteps, which it is, and also pointing out how did these people get here? Because we know that it was the Jews and the Khazar Jews who brought them over, but the way I see it is, these people have not got remote controls, which are controlling the blacks and the Pakis, to do these heinous things against us. A person is responsible for his own actions or a group.
Absolutely.
So I hope for Judith that answers her comment. I'm glad she made a comment. Mm-hmm. But, well, we've got 1 minute left. Thanks, Steve. I've enjoyed
no
this
problem.
Very much. Good luck with the British movement.
Thank
and,
you.
And I hope we can do this again sometime. I think Neil is a very good speaker. And I'll maybe you could come on with him. That would be really good.
We'll see what we can do.
Okay. And the website again is National Socialist
Outlook.
NS Outlook. So if people Google nsoutlook.com and send a comment, now get in touch with the BM.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.